We started this episode with the intent of discussing colorism, which we do, but it quickly evolved into a broader conversation between five Black women talking about our experiences.
We're Mel and Tam, and this is me, myself, I, and you.
All right. Thank you, ladies, so much for joining us. I just want to jump right in. This is going to be a really good conversation, I feel like. And Corey, I would like to start with you. How would you define colorism? And can you recall a time when you were affected by it?
Colorism to me definitely is discrimination against individuals that have a darker skin tone. This is typically probably among most African-Americans. And I would say probably a lot of ethnic and racial groups. Probably the first instance to me was not me specifically, but I have an older sister. Her name is Scarlett. She is darker, much darker than me. She takes after my mother. And for the longest time, she would come home from school because she was harassed by the same boy. His name was Bube. Don't ask me why his name was Bube. I have no idea. But anyway, Bube used to come home, but they used to, and probably Bube and other kids would always call her Skillet. And most of you probably know why, because of the black cast iron skillet. So that was probably the biggest introduction to me of like colorism, like, hey, Bube, like, you're not much lighter than my sister, but you're calling her a skillet, as opposed to her name Scarlett. So that was my first introduction to probably colorism, was just that lens through my mother and my sister.
So, and I wouldn't ask you to speak for your sister, but did that ever affect your relationship with her?
Not in that sense. I think as we started to get older, my mother and father were very active in their fraternities and their sororities. And later on in life, we also got into a lot of social organizations. And one that stuck out to me personally was, you guys may be familiar with Jack and Jill. Again, I'm not a member of Jack and Jill, but that was one instance where I wanted to be a member, but I was never invited to be a member of Jack and Jill. And that was the first conversation that my mother really had a conversation with me, that there are differences within our own community where people will completely discriminate against you because of your skin tone. It doesn't make you any better than the next person, but there are some organizations that are just outright discriminatory when it comes to you being a darker girl. And again, most people may think I shouldn't be calling myself a dark-skinned girl, but I still consider myself a very dark-skinned girl. So that is my pure introduction. That was at a very like young age. I think I was probably in middle school at the time when, again, a lot of my other friends were a part of Jack and Jill, but I just was not ever invited to be a part of Jack and Jill.
And can you explain to some of our listeners who may not know, can you give us a little bit of background about the organization itself?
So it's a social organization purely to uplift the community and inspire knowledge among the African-American community and teach individuals about growth and generational wealth, I think is probably one of the things that they focused on. A lot of the individuals that were or at least in our state, were, you know, doctors, lawyers. They were kids of, you know, dentists and architects. Again, my mother and father were not that. So it was just different that I didn't understand why I couldn't be a part of it at that young age.
Sure. Renee, how about you? How would you define colorism? And can you recall a time where you were affected by it?
I mean, I agree with Corey. It's about discrimination against, you know, your skin color, usually coming from, you know, your peers or someone who's darker than you. But I grew up, I'm biracial. My dad is white, my mom is Black. And so I actually experienced, you know, discrimination from both sides. On the one hand, you know, white people automatically just assume that you're Black, and then, you know, that's just your label, you're Black, it doesn't, you know. And then, you know, with my Black peers, you know, I'm too light-skinned to be Black. So, you know, I definitely grew up with, you know, myself and my sisters, and we're, you know, we're all different shades of light-skinned. But I grew up with, you know, being discriminated by both sides, but I didn't let that really affect me. I tried to befriend everyone and get to know them, you know, and kind of, and not that I knew much, you know, I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin. And so not that I knew much about, you know, discrimination, stuff like that. Actually, my parents didn't really talk to us. They talked to us a little bit about that. My grandparents talked to us a little bit about it, you know, and especially with my parents getting married in the 70s, that was like, you know, taboo. But, you know, their whole thing was to try to befriend everyone. And, you know, I guess to, you know, in a sense, to kind of move past those discriminatory thoughts that people have.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned something that I find to be so interesting. There's two sides of that discriminatory coin, right? Mm-hmm. And on one side, you say that maybe other people thought you weren't Black enough. Mm-hmm. What does that do, I guess, internally? Like, how do you internalize where you fit into that spectrum?
Yeah. I mean, it's not, so you said to try to fit in. It's not that, you know, I never tried to fit in with my Black friends, and I never tried to fit in with my white friends. I'm just Renee, I'm half Black and half white. And so, you know, take me as you are. But, you know, I'll speak on my sister, and Mel knows Carmen. You know, she's really fair. Like, she's the youngest and she's really, really fair. She looks like she's white. So on her side, you know, she struggled with, and Mel, don't tell Carmen, I'm saying all this. Anyway, Carmen will not be listening to this, but Carmen definitely, no, she will. She agrees. She struggled with, you know, trying to prove herself to be Black, because, you know, if you look at her, you're like, she's not Black. And she's still, to this day, is kind of like that. You know, and it's not because she looks white, so she doesn't have to necessarily prove herself, but to her Black peers and, you know, at work and stuff like that, she, you know, had struggles to prove that she is Black. She wants people to know. She didn't even want to do a DNA test because she was like, I'm going to come back as like 80% white, you know, but that's not going to happen because you're half, you know. But, yeah, but then, you know, with us growing up together, you know, we're really close, my two sisters and I, and we never talked about stuff like that to each other, you know, about, oh, you know, let's try to fit in on the white side or let's try to fit in on the Black side. We just, you know, try to, we didn't try to fit in, you know, we just were the Carter girls and we're mixed and, you know, we want to be friends with everyone, regardless of, you know, your skin color. We didn't, and, you know, and also with friends that are, you know, darker or lighter, we didn't, you know, that's just not something we even talked about, like, to each other. Like, you know, we never said things like that. And I think that comes from my parents as well. You know, I didn't see that kind of stuff on my mom's side with colorism and discrimination. And I didn't see that on my dad's side with, you know, with, you know, his all white side of the family. You know, I heard stories when we weren't born yet about, you know, racist things or, you know, discriminatory things that my dad's side of the family did. But then I think once him and my mom got married, then, you know, things changed. And, you know, they welcomed us just as much as, you know, my Black side of the family. and they all knew each other. It was kind of like, it's a, you know, small town, everybody knew each other. And then also definitely, you know, for 3 years we moved to Illinois, to an even smaller town, and there was like, you know, my sisters and I, my brother, who were mixed, and then like three other Black people at a school that was like 1,500 kids. So we definitely experienced, you know, discrimination from our peers, not from the teachers, but from the peer, from our peers.
Yeah. It certainly makes it easier to handle when you have such a supportive family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. Definitely.
Yeah.
But Corey, I know that you went to an HBCU and you did pledge. That's correct.
I did.
Okay. Yeah. And so when we talk about colorism and we talk about it in a historical context, right, there are all of these different things that we think about. We think about house slaves versus field slaves and just the difference in color, right? If you worked out in the fields, you were typically darker. And if you were in the house, it's because you were lighter and you had a preferred status. I mean, let's not get it twisted though. They were still slaves, right? And then come a little bit later, you've got the brown bag test. And if you are not familiar with the brown bag test, if your skin tone was lighter than a brown paper bag, you were given certain privileges and certain allowances into sororities and churches and social clubs and all of these things. So I'm wondering, Corey, on the campus of a historically Black college, did you see remnants or sort of just leftover ideology of some of these older concepts?
Absolutely. I mean, they were there. Some spoken to more than others, right? I am a part of the first sorority. I am an AKA. So again, there is a connotation that goes with that only light-skinned people can be AKAs, right? And this complexion here doesn't go with that. But again, I am also a legacy AKA, right? Like my mother is one, my sister is one. So that notion of you have to be a light-skinned woman to be a part of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated is just not true, right? We came in all different types of hues. So, but yeah, I think those discriminations are still very much in play, and probably still to this day with sororities and fraternities. I went to an all Catholic high school. So there were only 6 Black people in my class. And I mean, we're a small school. So my graduating class was of 42 people, but only 6 of us Black. So I mean, we totally grouped with each other. And we stood, again, catching that rabbit, trying to be the best and the brightest. I mean, all of us constantly staying after class, getting extra work. I mean, tutoring with the teachers just to make sure that every single one of us were in the top 10. Like we had a pact going in that all of us would be in the top 10 of our class. It was what we were chasing and what we were all trying to be. Because at that time, when we were starting to tell like where we were gonna go to school and what we were going to do, like that whole system of universities and where they rank. I mean, most of us were going to historically Black colleges and universities. And I can remember clear to this day, like telling one of my teachers, like, oh, I'm going to, you know, Tennessee State. And he was like, why would you go with there? He was like, that's just going to like, you know, South Carolina State University. And I was like, there's nothing wrong with South Carolina State University, but it would be better if I went to Notre Dame. He was like, it would be. And I'm like, it's not the place for me. Like, not the place. Like I can get in, but not the place for me. So it's just interesting.
Yeah. Nicole, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, I actually want to ask you, Corey, specifically, like you chose an HBCU and you committed to it. While you were there, did you feel as if you got a double education? Like you got book smart, you got educated about what you were going to do, your field of study, but also did you feel like you got some things that aren't in a book, like how to code switch, how to, you know, and you've been doing it all your life because you were at a Catholic school and there were so few of you, but just having to see like other minority professionals educated, be successful, be around you, say, hey, it's not enough that you have a GPA. It's not enough that you have this extracurricular. This is how you're going to have to navigate business, life, womanhood. Did you feel like you had more of that or an edge because you were at an HBCU?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, you've got professors that have been all around the world, and they've experienced lots of different things, right, that have happened to them. So, I mean, there is an education outside of the classroom. Maybe I should say that. So, I mean, I definitely felt like that.
Okay, I'm not sure if we are all familiar. My heart breaks every time I see the video. And I think back to my childhood, right? I played Barbies like it was legit my job. And I would say 85, 90% of my Barbies were white. And then I think about the doll test. Are we all familiar? And Renee, do you have any thoughts? Like, where do these ideas come from? Are we taught at an early age that Black is not beautiful or smart or any of the things that these children were asked?
So I am familiar with the doll test. It's when a therapist maybe or somebody has a bunch of stones and asks the young Black girl, which one does she think is more beautiful? And she points to the white doll. And so, you know, yeah, same, Tamala. When I see that, I'm just like, what in the world, you know? But, you know, I say what in the world, but I know where that comes from. It comes from the media. It comes from, you know, things that are ingrained in our families, you know, in our families being from, you know, from our parents, our grandparents. They're, you know, it's like a generational thing that's ingrained. And, you know, and then also, you know, in media, you know, I work in the entertainment industry, and it's so, you know, even growing up, and I'm sure when my parents and grandparents growing up, you constantly see white people in a positive light, you know, in high positions, lawyers, doctors, obviously in the White House and stuff like that. And so they get this idea that if you're white, you'll elevate in your career, you'll be better, you're prettier. People want to see that more than they want to see Black people. And it's really sad, you know, to about that video. And it's really sad, even, you know, in my industry, that stuff still happens all the time. You know, all the time, every day. There, you know, there's a big thing going on here in LA about that topic, about, you know, why aren't Black people represented in a positive light? You know, if we are, especially in film, it's, you know, we're slaves, and it's, you know, all these things that happened a long time ago. And it's, you know, shout out to Shonda for doing all these amazing shows that, you know, celebrate Black people in a positive way, you know. But yeah, it starts, it's something that's ingrained, and I don't necessarily know if it's, like purposeful. I think it's just something that it's just like, you know, it's ingrained in them. I don't know what other word to say. It's just, you know, if you're lighter skin or white, then, you know, you'll move up in this world. And I mean, how exciting is it to, you know, to see Kamala walking across the stage and all these little Black girls can, you know, can see that.
It's pretty amazing.
To see a Black girl in a
positive. I mean, I had to just break the wall. Tears, all tears. And I just feel like this is a fantastic, I think we just said this before we started, is that this is the first panel that we've had that's all Black women. And this is great, and it makes me feel powerful, and it makes me feel heard, and I just wanted to say that, and I'm gonna go back on mute, and you guys can go back to this.
It is incredibly inspiring. And also, I think that when I watch the doll test, and I think about what these what these young children have internalized. I don't think it's so much of what they're being told or what they're being taught. It's what they're not seeing. Mm-hmm. They're not seeing images of Black and brown people in positions of beauty and in power. Just echoing exactly what you just said. So it's not that necessarily they're being told you can't be this, you can't be that. They just don't see it. And so it makes it that much more difficult to realize, oh, yes, you can. Yeah. You can be all of these things. And it's really interesting. What do you think, Corey?
So again, I mean, the doll test to me just, it's just painful, right? It's painful to watch. Even the mention of the name makes me very hot inside, right? Because again, I mean, I was one of those little girls who wanted, you know, like a doll that looked like me. And for the longest time, there weren't dolls that looked like me. I mean, the first doll that I ever got, his name was Lance, and he was a little bald head Cabbage Patch kid, because there weren't any that were available. And my mom searched long and hard because I wanted a Cabbage Patch doll, right? Like that was the thing that was out. But then after that, she sought out a woman that made me an adoption doll, right? Like made me a brown skin adoption doll with pretty long hair that had twisted. And I held on to that doll for as long as I possibly could, because again, I had friends that were around me that didn't have, you know, a mom like mine that was telling them, you know, you're pretty, you're beautiful, you're smart, you're kind, like you can do and be whatever you want to be, like, and don't you ever forget that. And I had friends that didn't have that in their household. And so they were looking to other people to reinforce that in them. And of course, you know, my parents were always going to be those people to do that. But I mean, that's only for a couple of hours a day. And then they have to go home to their parents that are totally spewing just nonsense when it comes to, you know, equality and Black and white people. It's just sad. It's sad that little minds way back when, right? Like years before even us had to endure this type of psychological, just like cruelty to me. I mean, it's just insane to think that kids so young back then couldn't identify with a doll that looked like them. And even the fact that like during the doll test, they say like, which doll, you know, is bad? Like, which one do you associate with being bad? Like, that's what hurt me to the core. Like, not the prettiest, but that which doll is bad? And you instantly go to the darker skin. I mean, it's just, what is the media? What are the parents? What is society teaching our little minds? I mean, I have to feel that it's getting better now, but I still know, again, me living in the South, it's there, it's real, and it's going to take a long time to correct it.
Well, we talk about it all the time, right? Representation matters, mm-hmm. and images matter, and it is so, so important to get these images and these positive images of people of color in front of these young minds to try to undo some of that generational damage that has been done. Nicole, do you have any thoughts regarding the doll test?
I just hate it. I mean, I'm with everybody else. It's heartbreaking. I definitely feel, you know, just echoing what all of you ladies have said, that for those children, those innocent little beautiful faces, to have been affected by what they see and experience in life in such a way, to have them with that decision. But you have to think about, if I'm on the TV and I don't see me, if in authority in my neighborhood, in my community, I don't see me, my police don't look like me, you know, my mayor doesn't look like me, you know, for me, my neighbors didn't look like me. It is real easy to feel like I don't see me represented, so that must mean something wrong or negative or bad. So it's just always so ridiculously heartbreaking because, you know, like Corey said, I can remember exactly the Christmas I got my first black Barbie. I can remember exactly the time I made my mom pull over because I saw my first black fireman. And when you think about things like that, you know, here are these innocent little kids in this doll test. That's real life, even right now in 2020. Mm-hmm. You will have plenty of children who still will answer in those exact same ways.
Yeah. And Corey, you brought up a really good point, just having, and I think we've touched on it just across a couple of different topics, but having that reinforcement at home that says, even though you don't see these things out here, this is who you are, and you are worthy and you are validated, and all of these amazing things that can happen within the home, even if they're not happening in the outside world. But what happens when that's not happening in your home? I have a family member who stays on social media talking about light brights this, high yellow this, these are my ladies, I only date light-skinned women. And what does that do? Like, do we allow, I don't want to say necessarily allow men to drive the narrative that could potentially put different shades of people at odds with each other, but it happens, right? And has there ever been a situation, and I'll start with you, Renee, has there ever been a situation where you felt like you were put in direct competition with other women who may have been lighter or darker than yourself?
As far as like my industry or?
Across the board, industry and relationships.
Relationships, I'm going to say no. And I think, you know, about the, you know, men only want to, you know, you see like men saying they only want to date light skinned women and blacks women. That goes back to the same thing that we were talking about. You know, it's ingrained in them that lighter is, you know, somehow better. You know, so that's something that's ingrained, and it also has to do with their own self-consciousness and, you know, insecurities and stuff like that. In the industry, it's hard because, okay, I'm usually the only black person on set. And, you know, and when I come on set, automatically there's stereotypes. Let's play hip hop music and like, you know, all this stuff and like, you know, trying to come up and dance. And I'm just like, you know, I mean, the reaction that you should see that I do when that happens is priceless. So a lot of times, because I think they think, oh, Renee's lighter, so she's going to be down and like this and that. But in fact, I'm not like that. So turn that music off because I don't listen to music like that. And you're disrespecting me.
Right. Then also, we're at work. Be appropriate.
Also, we're at work. They don't care.
I mean,
they don't care. And do I get hired back for those jobs? No. So they'll go to the next, you know, black girl who might be lighter or darker, who will tolerate those kind of things.
And give them what they want.
And give them what they want. But, I mean, definitely, you know, there's a lot, and especially with talent, you know, hiring lighter skinned girls, because it's just assumed that, oh, it'll sell better. And that this has happened, you know, throughout my 20 years in my career. That's always like that. There's always a light-skinned girl with curly hair or, you know, straighter hair or something like that. Because the production, who's all white, just automatically thinks that's what people want to see, you know, what the, sure, you know, people outside, you know, and you know, where whatever town want to see that. Now I do see a slight change in that, you know, because representation matters. So I think a lot of companies are trying to, you know, they're trying to step up and hire people of, you know, every ethnicity because they see, you know, light doesn't mean better, you know, and dark, you know, like, Corey said, doesn't mean bad. It's all these, you know, these stereotypes and things that you've been ingrained with and things that you're trying to please whoever you're trying to please that don't mean anything and they don't work, that it, you know, it just doesn't work. And especially today, and I feel like even with like the younger generation, they are stepping up big time, you know, to let people know this isn't, like, this isn't right. Like, this all needs to end. I'm like super proud of this, you know. I thought my generation, Gen X, was like about it, but no.
I mean, we thought we were doing something, right?
That is so true. We sure did.
Yeah. And it's so nice to see, like,
Gen Z is in this.
Yeah, so it's so nice to see breaks in, like I mentioned earlier, just the generational trauma, like having these ideas that being Black means something, or being seven and scrubbing your skin thinking that the brown is going to come off because it feels dirty, or any of those things. Melanie, did you have something that you wanted to add?
I always have something that I want to add.
Of course you do.
So I think the root, I pretty much say this on every episode that we record, the root, when you get to the root, is the difference between a field Negro and a house Negro, and colonialism. And when you talk about Sally Hemings and the light and the light and the light and the light and the light, right? And the treatment of people who were in the house versus the treatment of people that were in the field. The field was rough, but the house was rough too. And it was in particular rough for women, if you know what I'm saying. So there's no saying no in the house either. So there's something to be said for that. And so I think that there is this image of people who are in the field of what it's like to be in the house, and the vice versa, right? One has it better than the other, but nobody is having a true understanding of the pain and the suffering regardless. And from, in my mind, a slave is a slave is a slave is a slave. You are enslaved people. You have no freedoms and no choice in your life. Mm-hmm. And where this all, in my mind, and again, this is just my opinion, where this all derives from, and where we all have had to rebuild our self-esteem and that generational trauma, comes from whether you were in the house or you were in the field.
Well, I think that goes back to the visual as part of it as well. Like, so if Renee is saying that her industry is saying, hey, if we are going to pick minorities in the way of production, this is what's visually appealing, light skin, you can also say to the fact that, okay, that slaves in the field are not visible. That's the invisible work. But slaves in the house are visible because they are serving at your mealtime. You are seeing these individual images. And sometimes I feel like without really feeling like they see that, that when it does come to entertainment and production, that that is why they would assume that, oh, well, if we're going to do an African-American or a minority, we're going to do the light skin because that's what they want to see.
Yeah. And you think of the stories that are told of Black people, even up until the last 10, 20 years, largely they were about living in the hood, being a slave, being a mammy, like these in which we talk about in one of our previous episodes, the depictions of people of color in film and TV there are way more slaves and criminals than there are Claire Huxtables.
Doctors
well,
and lawyers.
They're way more uneducated. Think
well,
about
yeah.
A Different World was the first time we really got to see Minority College. Because if you think about it, before you had Family Matters and things like that, but it was the first time you got to see minority education as the forefront and the theme of anything.
And Denise was messing up messing up her first year of college. Can we talk about that? It's like, Denise, you need to do better for the people. you're going to college for all the people.
Right. But again, friction was there, right? Friction was there. And Kim, and then you had Freddie. All different types of cues, but all different types of friction between those ladies in that environment.
Yeah. So, they all came from extremely different backgrounds, and they all had, much like the ladies on this call, there's a wide spectrum and palette of skin tone and experience. And they too, like your sisters at AKA Corey, they had a white girl. I don't know if you guys remember Marissa Tomei was on there going to an college. It was like the coolest thing ever. But I mean, and all those ladies are still friends to this day. I just thought I would point that out. If you follow them on Instagram, every single one of them are best friends to this day, which I find to be really amazing and beautiful. My I think from where I'm sitting and what I'm interested in, and Tamla, I'll promise I will be quiet soon, is that how does that, like, I don't know about you guys, but seeing those ladies built my self-esteem. You know, it's one thing that I hear from people, it's like, oh, you're so confident. I'm really just a loud mouth. But that confidence came from watching TV shows like that, seeing women like that, because that's all I did was watch TV, because all I wanted to do was be a producer my entire whole life. So a lot of TV, and I saw these beautiful Black women on TV, and then it just would get better piece by piece, it would get better and better. How do we all think that this plays into our self-esteem? Tamla, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think back to my adolescence and this healing process, right, of having to deal with growing up with darker skin than the majority of my peers. That's been a long go. You know, I think that it's been in my adulthood that I've been able to reconcile a lot of those past feelings. And I don't know, Nicole, do you have any thoughts about how do we get back maybe some of the value that we feel we didn't have as children?
Well, I always try to sew into any woman, young or old, that I come in. It's almost like a mission for me, because my household was very much like Corey's. Mm-hmm. Can't was a bad word, like butthead. So it'd be like, oh, I can't be a ballerina because I'm fat. Well, you need to figure out how you can meet your goal. So I was fortunate enough to have that built in, so that affected my esteem differently, where even though there were barriers like, no, I'm not light skin, and no, I'm not the ideal body size, I still grew up with a lot of confidence. My insecurities were a little different than most in the way of that. So whether it's young women at church, you know, that you see them, I'm always going to the fatties. I want to pick them off of the Christmas tree when I see 6X or a size 16. I'm the person that wants to buy that person not something cheap, something good quality, so they feel valued and they understand that just because your size is a little bit larger or just because your zip code's a little bit whatever, you can still dream huge dreams. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you look like. I don't care what your current situation is, that your current situation can't limit your dreams. And so, yeah, playing into that esteem, it was TV shows like that. I did mention that, you know, seeing that education, because education was the driving force in our house. But the other thing about A Different World that we don't really even talk about much is they had the same dynamic with the men, because you had light skin Ron, mm-hmm. and then you had Kadeem Harrison, right? Then you had dark skin Sarge, but you also had Sinbad. So they were doing a different age thing, right? Because they were older members, and you had these younger members, but you also had men. It's often only minority women that often voice their differences. Minority men don't seem to have it as much as women, because they often get the pass. So they don't have to have conversations about where their womanhood, their minority, and within the hue of Blackness affects their esteem like women have to. So, absolutely. You know, it's, I just try to make it a total point that it doesn't matter to me, Black woman, Asian woman, you know, Japanese child, if it is a young female, old female that I interact with daily, I want to empower them. I want to encourage them. I want to acknowledge them, period. Grocery store, stranger, friend, whatever.
That's awesome.
I feel like we say that all the time between Mel, me, you, and Tamla, like all the time, again, in our industry, like, we're all we got. Like, we are usually the only Black face that is there in our industry when we are on site for a program, and are constantly, like, again, self-affirming ourselves, like, you got this. You are good at what you fucking do. Don't you dare forget it. Like, and don't let anybody else tell you that you're not. And so
again, pay me my worth.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So caveat, Mel, Willie thinks that you totally should have this whole conversation with men too about colorism.
We've discussed
Interesting. It. Interesting. We've discussed it. And it might be a colorism part too, because I don't know, terrible idea. And I think you know, right now we're just focused on the Black ladies.
We are focused on the Black ladies, and for a couple of different reasons, right? I think it's so important that we remember to lift each other up, right? We say this all the time, and support each other. But we also, and I shouldn't even say but, we lift each other up and we support each other, recognizing all of the things that we had to go through to get here, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the ways that we are better able to support and lift each other up. Back to the original question, just regarding self-esteem and images and things that you sort of clung to growing up. Renee, do you have any thoughts?
You know, okay, I'm going to talk about in my industry. That's where I see a lot of self-esteem issues. I recall this one of the girls that I was working with when she was maybe 7. You know, we came on set, her hair is like mine. You know, I'm taking it out of the twist, making it big. And then she says to me, I don't want to wear my hair like yours. She's a darker girl. I don't want to wear my hair like yours. I don't think it looks pretty. I want to, you know, wear it like, you know, some white girl on set. And so, and this happens constantly on set with me, with my young, kids that I work with. But, And so having self-esteem about not looking white enough, you know, and, you know, that goes back to, you know, what we were saying earlier, is things that are ingrained, things that what they see on TV, they think that looks better. So like Nicole was saying, you know, I try to, uplift, you know, these ones that I work with, get them past these insecurities that they have. And, you know, and it's hard because these things are ingrained. So it's even having someone, you know, like Nicole, that's around you, like having a positive influence on you to bring you out of those things. And even, you know, it's sometimes the parents that I have to talk to as well, that say these things, you know, to bring their self-esteem down. And so, yeah, I think just, you know, there's definitely a lot of self-esteem issues. I mean, and people are human. This is just what happens. People have insecurities. People have low self-esteem about certain issues. The most beautiful person, whatever that means to anyone, has self-esteem issues, you know, because we're human beings. But it's learning how to not let that, like, bring you down and not compare yourself with others because you think that the way that they look is going to get you to a higher place.
Yeah, totally.
So I was going to say, just to tag on to what you were saying, Tamala, is again, it is truly up to us to instill that, like, greater evaluation of self for the younger generation, right? Like, again, you're still going to have those little girls and little boys who still have issues with self-esteem to this day. And whether that be they just don't have the right people supporting them or surrounding them. But again, it is truly up to us, again, one person at a time, to truly instill a greater sense of worth and value for these kids that are coming up today. And again, I think Gen Z is killing it when it comes to that. I think the movement about Black hair is instilling a strong sense of empowerment for the Black woman, right? For those little girls who don't have the ability to, like, straighten their hair every day and don't have the ability to do that. I just think it's a strong movement right now that is pushing everyone to really look within their own self, you know, to really focus on instilling your own self-worth and self-esteem and bringing that to light.
Well, I think that is, it's so necessary. I love like Amazon and the Black Ballerina commercials, because you do need to see that, hey, you need to make these tights in some darker hues. It's necessary and we're here and we're ready. But also very much to what you're saying, these Gen Zs, they are impatient. And so they're forcing, no, I don't want to wait 50 years like my parents. I want you to do it now. Right. I want to write policy now. I can get on social media and get 500 people here right now. And what that is I wish I had that kind of rally to go to when I'm at a slumber party explaining why I've got to tie down my hair. When I'm at a pool party explaining why I can only sit on the steps because I'm not going to get beat up for getting this fresh pressed wet. Girl. You know, and so all that conversation, these young women get to see it in real life when you got newscasters and Bantu knots all down there. But, you know, I mean, it's amazing that you think something as simple as hair would affect esteem. It would affect a whole industry, you know, just beauty, just networking. You're totally missing out on celebrating this, and that I'm excited that these young people don't have to do some of those, you know, it is a hard slumber party to go to when you are the only woman of color. So here you come with your pillowcase and your pillow, not because you know, want them to know you slob. It's just like, if I accidentally don't tie my hair down and disobey my mom, at least it's on the good pillowcase, you know.
But listen, but let's say that you don't tie up your hair because you don't want everybody looking at you crazy, and then you wake up in the morning and you look crazy anyway. So like, it doesn't even matter. But something that you made me think of, Nicole, you and I had freshman PE together and swimming. And every day in shower caps, and everyone was like, what are they doing? Why are they wearing shower caps?
You have to understand, we went to Cabrillo High School, whose colors were yellow and black, and my mom put this round body in the brightest yellow shower cap you have ever seen in life, because it was cheaper than the black one. Okay. We were stretching them dollars so I could have some things, but right, we had freshman PE, and my class was right before lunch, and I was late to lunch all the time. Like, oh, we're going to meet up by the DJ booth, or we're going to meet in the library, or, you know, we're going to have snow. And I'd be like, girl, I'm in here trying to work this hair out. A couple of them edges got out of the hat in the water.
I mean, you guys, this sheer terror, and I don't know if other kids had freshmen swimming, like the
California requirement.
Yes, I was like, what am I going to do? Because the whole thing, if you were a black girl, you were like, shit, what period am I going to have PE? Is it, if it's second period, third period, fourth period, you needed it to be fourth period so you had time to get fixed up before you had time lunch. But if you had that between like second and third or fifth and sixth, like, you're done for the day. You're not cute. It ruins your whole high school career because you're not going to be able to get snatched up in time, and there's no pressing comb in the Cabrillo High School girls' locker room.
Or you could just be me and sit on the steps the entire time. I refuse.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Let's just talk about like the gaslighting of like unacceptable like black parenting. On one hand, I was not allowed to fail the class. On the other hand, I was not allowed to have my mom have to sit down and do my hair for 3 or 4 hours. So it was like, I'm just fucked, like, on either end. I don't win.
Ugh. Yeah, I took that passing, whatever it was.
Yeah, I think we need to have a whole series on pool stories and slumber parties. So thank you, Nicole, for bringing up that deep, deep pain.
You know, seeing, okay, so for me growing up, I mean, I really don't remember hardly seeing a black girl. I mean, we got Naomi Campbell and Tyra, there's maybe three that I would see growing up. But so what you are seeing are these like tall, thin, blonde, you know, models and actresses. And, you know, that brings your self-esteem down because, you know, I don't look like them, and that's what everybody likes and everybody wants to see, that type of person. Now, fast forward to, you know, 2020, basically, and now you see people of all shades, all sizes, which I love that.
Yeah, I think that we all have our hangups, right? But it's at the end of the day, it seems that people across different industries are starting to realize that people want to see themselves.
Yeah.
Right. So I want to see someone who maybe has hair like me or is, I don't know, wearing glasses, whatever the case may be. Like, I want to see some sort of representation across the board. And I think that you're right. I think we're heading in the right direction.
I think the beauty industry, like, I love that they're being all inclusive. I feel like there is an access issue. And then I also feel like there is a markup issue. I can go to Fenty, I can get this lip gloss, and it's going to last me 22 days, and I've paid $15 for it. I can buy this same $8.99 clear lip gloss from Bath and Body Works, and it's going to last me 45 days. I feel like because it's marketed to us, and it is in all these color shades and arrays that are exciting to us, that we are willing to, A, spend our money and resources to have it shipped to us, because it's never available locally, and then, you know, to have it somehow be shortchanged, so I don't get enough bang for my buck at this already marked up. So I even look at the basics, like CoverGirl. My CoverGirl color is Toasted Almond. Okay, CoverGirl is at every Walmart, Walgreens in America. I can't roll into my Walmart and Walgreens. It's not there. Beige is there, and light beige is there. They don't have that. They don't carry, when Queen Latifah did her line, they didn't carry that locally. You couldn't get that. Milani and all these things that these young people have, I didn't have. I used to get my makeup from Aman. I used to have to buy it in the middle of the mall. And the only time I had access to that was when I lived in Dallas. Okay, I would go to Valley View Mall, right there at the kiosk. She's only there every like second and third Friday. And the freaking compact was $26. And I was 21 years old on a student. Like, oh my God, this is my good makeup. It's for that one date, that one interview. I couldn't wear it every day. And I just feel like you push all this marketing, every Vogue, every InStyle, you know, every Cosmo that does not have a minority face on the cover. You're selling me all this product, telling me that this is what I need to be beautiful. And even when I go out there to attempt to meet this unbelievable standard of beauty, the access you're limiting to me, even when I'm willing and ready to give you my chochos, it's not there. You know, I told you, I've been wearing the same Revlon color for the last 10 years, and Revlon only has two colors for me, and that is it. I'm like, I love this color stay, but you only have two colors for me, this clear and this red.
I mean I've been wearing the exact same makeup probably since 1995, and they continually discontinue my colors. I shake my fist at L'Oreal all the time because, you know, that's my color, and now I have to go to Amazon because those things are not available locally. And the markup that I'm paying is insane. Corey, do you have any thoughts about the beauty industry and colorism and the things that we face as women of color?
Again, just probably echo what the ladies already have said. Again, I'm extremely proud of those companies that are making strong statements in the face of identifying that there have been has been a huge imbalance, I guess, when we talk about color for women, especially in the beauty industry, right? Like, it's just been, I don't wear makeup on a regular basis, and not because I haven't wanted to before, but my sister probably didn't teach me how to do it, right? So I didn't grow up wanting to wear makeup and things and putting on foundation and things like that. So again, even when I sought out to, like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, at least try and things, again, I never could find that perfect color that matched exactly what, and then just the whole of trying to blend two together, it's just too much.
Like, it's a lot of work.
It is, it's a lot of work. Like, Renee, I'm just like, how do you do it all? It's amazing. I look at your work, I'm like, this is amazing, it's an art. But again, I think that there's still a lot of gaps, right? I think those industries right now are just capitalizing in the moment of what is happening. You know, had the whole incident with George Floyd not happen? Would we be seeing these movements in the beauty industry and what we're seeing across the board with so many different companies and organizations now? I don't think that would have been the case, right? I think it would have just been ignored for the years and years and that it has been ignored. So again, hats off to those companies that are really, really recognizing that there is a huge imbalance when it comes to representing people of color across the beauty industry. But again, we've still got a long, long way to go, long way to go.
So I've got one last question, and I'm going to start with you, Corey. Nicole has answered this question, so I'm just going to kick it to the other two. Corey, what do you find to be the most valuable thing about having an open heart?
I don't know. That's very special to me. I live in the realm of positivity and optimism, right? So with that, you have to have an open heart. And I honestly do think that, like, our culture is centered around that wholeheartedly, right? Like, we are always the culture that is forgiving. We are the culture that is always open. We are always the culture that's, I think, approachable. We are listeners, and wholeheartedly just come with a sense of an open heart. So, I mean, that's truly how I feel I am and how our culture is as a people.
Thank you. Renee, same question. What do you find to be the most valuable thing about having an open heart?
I think when you have an open heart, you don't limit yourself to human beings. You're accepting. And, you know, a lot of all the words that Corey was saying, I totally agree. Having a closed heart means you have a problem with this or that from someone. You know, you can't grow when you have a closed heart. You can't learn from someone when you have a closed heart. So having an open heart, you know, having a closed heart, that's a negative thing. You're closing yourself off from something that you could grow from and you could learn from. Having an open heart, you are allowing maybe things that you didn't understand, that you don't understand to learn from, you know? You know, one of the things, you know, and you know, with teaching my son, he's almost 7, is to have an open heart and be, you know, just accepting of people and not something that you're trying to do. It's just a normal thing, learning from other people, you know, making other people feel comfortable and accepting them for who they are and learning about who they are as a person, their culture, and, you know, things like that.
Awesome. Thank you all ladies so much for the amazing conversation. I appreciate your openness. I know Melanie does too. And until next time. All right. I'm not sure if everyone is familiar with the show Black AF on Netflix. If you have not watched it, I strongly recommend it. It's hilarious and it's super smart. And throughout the season, we see Black art sort of playing the supporting role in the background. And in one episode in particular, there's this huge painting that's hanging up in the living room. And throughout the episode, everyone is just like, I don't get it. I don't understand it. This doesn't make sense. And then finally, towards the end of the episode, the artist, whose name is Knowledge Bennett, just sort of pops up out of nowhere and he explains what the painting means to him. And I found it to be so insightful and so beautiful. And I just wanted to share that quote. And he says, as Black people, there's so many different things, variations of so many different colors. And it's the sum total of all of these colors that presents Blackness in its purest form. in all of its brilliance, all of its splendor. That's our show. Thanks for listening.